Welcome to the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better editor, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years' experience. My name is Leslie Watts, and I'll be moderating the roundtable today. Joining me shortly are three of my fellow certified StoryGrid editors, Valerie Francis, Anne Holly, and Kim Kessler. Jari Belander has been on assignment in Denmark this past week. Each week, we watch a movie from one of the 12 content genres and complete a global foolscap worksheet, then discuss it using the 6 core questions. This week, we're analyzing the 2016 movie Hidden Figures, based on the book of the same name by Margot Lee Shetterly. Screenplay by Allison Schroeder and Theodore Melfi, and directed by Theodore Melfi. Here's a synopsis adapted from Wikipedia. In 1961, mathematician Catherine Goebel works as a human computer in the segregated division of NASA's Langley Research Center alongside her colleagues, aspiring engineer Mary Jackson, and their unofficial acting supervisor, Dorothy Vaughn. Following the successful Soviet launch of an astronaut or cosmonaut into space, pressure to send American astronauts into space increases. Al Harrison, the director of the Space Task Group, needs someone who can perform analytic geometry, and Catherine is the only one who can do it. She becomes the first Black woman on that team. Catherine's new colleagues initially dismiss her, especially head engineer Paul Stafford. Dorothy is told she won't be promoted to supervisor of the group of African-American women computers who do complex computations, not the machines, because there are no plans to assign a permanent supervisor for the group. Meanwhile, Mary is assigned to the space capsule heat shield team and immediately identifies a flaw. With encouragement from the team leader, she submits an application to an official NASA engineer position and begins to pursue an engineering degree. Harrison invites his team to solve a complex mathematical equation, and Catherine develops the solution, leaving him impressed. The Mercury 7 astronauts visit Langley, and astronaut John Glenn makes a point of greeting the people supporting the mission, including the African-American computers. When Harrison finds out that Catherine is forced to walk a half mile to another building to use the bathroom each day, he becomes enraged and ends bathroom segregation by knocking down the colored bathroom sign and announcing, "We all pee the same color." Harrison allows Catherine to be included in the briefings, where she creates an equation to guide the space capsule during re-entry. Despite this, Catherine is forced to remove her name from the reports, which are credited solely to Stafford. Meanwhile, Mary goes to court and convinces the judge to grant her permission to attend white-only night classes to obtain her engineering degree. Dorothy learns of the impending installation of an IBM electronic computer that could replace the human computers. She visits the computer room to learn about it and successfully starts the machine. Later, she visits a public library where the librarian scolds her for visiting the whites-only section to borrow a book about Fortran. After teaching herself programming and training her coworkers, she's officially promoted to supervise the programming department, but not before securing employment for 30 of her coworkers. As the final arrangements for John Glenn's launch are made, Catherine is reassigned to her old group because the task force will rely on calculations from the IBM. Catherine's colleagues give her a pearl necklace, the only jewelry allowed under the dress code, and a piece of jewelry that she doesn't currently own. On the day of the launch, Harrison discovers discrepancies in the IBM calculations for the capsule's landing coordinates and astronaut Glenn requests that Catherine be called in to check them. She quickly does so, only to have the door slammed in her face after delivering the results to the control room. However, Harrison gives her a security pass so she can attend the liftoff. Stafford, showing a change of heart, brings Catherine a cup of coffee. After a successful launch and orbit, the space capsule has a heat shield problem. Mission Control decides to land it after 3 orbits instead of 7. Catherine suggests they leave the retro rocket attached to the heat shield for re-entry. The instructions are effective, and Friendship 7 successfully lands. Following the mission, the mathematicians are laid off and ultimately replaced by the computers, electronic computers, that is. Catherine is reassigned to the analysis and computation division. Dorothy continues to supervise the programming department, and Mary obtains her engineering degree and becomes NASA's first African-American aeronautical engineer. An epilogue reveals that Catherine calculated the trajectories for the Apollo 11 and space shuttle missions. In 2015, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The following year, NASA dedicated the Langley Research Center's Catherine G. Johnson Computational Building in her honor. Dorothy is NASA's first African-American supervisor and becomes a Fortran specialist and is described as one of the most brilliant minds at NASA. Okay, we begin our discussion of the 6 core questions with the global genre. Here we have a performance, professional, external genre for the global with the external value of respect and shame. The performance story is an arch plot, which is the hero's journey or mini plot with multiple characters, external genre that culminates in the big event when the heroes are forced to display all their gifts under duress and society's critical evaluation. That's a quote from Sean Coyne to kind of give you the flavor and what we're going for with a performance story. It includes 3 levels of conflict: extrapersonal, interpersonal, and intrapersonal. And here we have the internal genre, I would argue, is status admiration, where the principled protagonist rises without compromise. This definitely feels like a mini plot. We have 3 prominent characters with similar challenges. And without Mary's and Dorothy's work, the mission wouldn't have been successful. So with that, we will move on to the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff, which Anne is going to walk us through.
Because we have a lot to talk about with this movie, I'm just going to read the 1-sentence beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff, and the actual inciting incident and so forth, the 5 commandments, will be in the show notes. So the beginning hook summarizes this way, at least I summarize it this way: as 3 African-American women face down bigotry and misogyny to do their highly skilled jobs at NASA in the Jim Crow South of 1961, the U.S. space program loses the initial race to beat the Russians to space when Russia puts Sputnik into orbit. Now, this leaves out everything about Catherine, Mary, and Dorothy, but it does bring up one of the things that we are discussing at length, which is this is a story about NASA and the space race and the Cold War and all kinds of very external things that overstructure the personal stories of the women. The middle build is when the Russians beat the U.S. to a manned Earth orbit, everyone at NASA must work at inhuman levels to put an American in space and solve the problem of bringing him back safely, with the pivotal tasks falling to our 3 protagonists, though they must continue to deal with racism and misogyny and incredible amounts of overwork at the same time. And the ending payoff is when it's discovered that the IBM computer has made a mistake. Catherine is called back in to do manual calculations, saving the mission and John Glenn's life, after which she and her 2 colleagues receive recognition and promotion at NASA and go on to have illustrious careers. There are 3 storylines, 1 for each of the protagonists, as Leslie has pointed out, and they blend and meet at key points. Now, I've focused on Catherine's story. I think we all agree she's the central protagonist and spends the most time on screen. But it would be much less of a story without the interweaving of Mary's and Dorothy's quests to rise in their respective fields. And it struck me both times I've seen this movie that it's a well-constructed screenplay, but behind this wonderful, warm sense of victory that you come out of the movie with, I'm left feeling that it lacks a certain substance. And I think we're going to go into this further as the discussion proceeds.
Great. Thank you. Yes, we have some good discussion to come on that. So next we talk about the obligatory scenes of a performance story, and Valerie is going to talk about those with us.
Yeah, there's, as Anja said, there's three storylines, and all three of the characters have their own obligatory scenes. Right now, I'm just going to go through Catherine, but I will have in the show notes information for all three characters. Okay, so the performance genre has eight obligatory scenes. The first one is an inciting performance opportunity. And Catherine gets this when she's assigned to the Space Task Force because there's no one from the East group of computers who is qualified to handle analytic geometry. The second one is that the protagonist sidesteps responsibility to perform. Now, in this film, it's subtle and it's incremental. Sometimes when we're analyzing films, we want to see one big scene that delivers what it's supposed to do. But in this case, it's incremental and it's sort of dotted throughout. And for my money, it's way more satisfying. So for example, we see that Catherine experiences self-doubt when she's first assigned to Harrison's group. She isn't sure that she can keep up. And she even says to Dorothy and Mary that, you know, she'll probably be back with the other computers before very long. They tell her not to be so foolish, and so she continues on. Later, when she's asked to verify Stafford's numbers, she says, "I cannot work on what I cannot see, Mr. Stafford," because, of course, he's given her a heavily redacted document. Again, she overcomes this fairly quickly because she holds it up to the light, and she's able to read through some of the black ink, which makes Harrison says, "I think darker ink is a good idea." The third obligatory scene is this. Forced to perform, the protagonist lashes out. In this case, it's a fairly overt scene, and it's fantastic. This is when Harrison questions Catherine about her absence and where she's been. He says, "Where the hell have you been? Every time I look up, you're not where I need you to be. Now, where the hell have you been?" And she flips out and tells him that she's had to run back and forth to the bathroom a half a mile each way, and she's standing there soaking wet. And this, interestingly, is the midpoint shift of the movie. Now, in StoryGrid, Sean doesn't talk specifically about a midpoint shift, but for those of you who are interested in story structure, you're going to eventually go on to read people like Christopher Vogler and others who deal primarily with film, not novels. And in film, they do talk a lot about the four-act structure. And basically, all that does is provide different ways of looking at the middle build, because the middle build is a beast. So in the four-act structure, you still have your beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff, but the middle build is broken into two parts. And there's a big turning point in the middle called a midpoint shift. And in this case, when Catherine lashes out and yells at Harrison, that's right in the middle of the movie. That's the midpoint shift, and that's when people, notably the other people in the task force group, they start to look at Catherine as a person who has value and who can contribute to the team. The next obligatory scene is when the protagonist discovers and understands the antagonist's object of desire. This is also incremental. In Catherine's story, Paul Stafford is the antagonist, and she discovers his objects of desire through his actions, which is fantastic. There's no big speech that says, "This is what I want." We know he doesn't want to be questioned. He doesn't like his numbers to be guessed or seconded or confirmed by anyone else. He says that to her. He observes protocol, and he doesn't want it to be breached. So as a result, he gives Catherine redacted documents. He refuses to let her co-author reports, and he refuses to allow her to sit in on classified meetings. Then we have the protagonist's initial strategy to outmaneuver the antagonist fails. I see Catherine's initial strategy for her to get recognition for the work she's done. Her initial strategy is to put her name without authority on the cover of the report for the launch and landing projections. Of course, Stafford tears that off and tells her that computers don't author reports, but she already knew that. The next obligatory scene, the protagonist, realizing she must change her approach in order to salvage some form of honor, reaches an all-is-lost moment. Now, there's two areas in this, in Catherine's story, that you can look at as an all-is-lost moment. The obvious one is toward the end of the middle build when Harrison says, "Sorry, I have to send you back to the computer group because the IBM is here to take your place." Yes, I can see why people would think that's an all-is-lost moment. However, for me, the real all-is-lost moment for Catherine comes in that scene in the corridor outside the classified meeting room. I think it's the second time they're outside this room. She has tried time and time again to prove that she can do the work that they're asking her to do, but the data that she's given is always out of date. So her all-is-lost moment is that she is doomed to failure all of the time because the information that Stafford is giving her is not up to date. And she knows that in order for her to prove herself, she's got to take the bull by the horns and get into that classified meeting. And this is when she asks Stafford if she can go in. Stafford says no, but luckily Harrison is not 10 feet away and he lets her in. So I think that's her all is lost moment when Stafford finally says, no, she can't go into the meeting. She's got no other recourse. Now, unfortunately, and I know we're going to talk about this a bit in a bit, that all is lost moment goes by so quickly, we don't get a chance to really sink into it and really feel it. Moving on. The next obligatory scene is the big event, of course, in a performance story toward the end of the story. This is the core event of a performance story, and it's when the protagonist's gift is expressed. In Catherine's story, this is on the launch day when John Glenn is going into space. The IBM miscalculates the landing coordinates. So Glenn says, I want Catherine to do it. So Catherine then calculates the landing with more accuracy and more decimal places than the IBM. Her gift is truly expressed. Finally, the protagonist is rewarded at one or more levels of satisfaction on the external, interpersonal, or internal level. On the external level, in 2016, NASA dedicated a building to Catherine, and at the age of 97, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. It took a while, quite a while after the time period that the story takes place, and we're told about it sort of in an epilogue, but it still happened. Interpersonal, Glenn, Harrison, and Stafford all recognize her ability. Catherine is invited to work as part of the Apollo 2 mission and the space shuttle. And right at the end of the movie, we see Stafford getting her coffee, and he recognizes that her name should be on the report, so she gets a byline. Internally, Catherine has pride in her personal achievement, but she also achieves a happy marriage that, as of 2016, had lasted 56 years.
Wow, that's great. Thanks for that, Valerie. Now, Kim is going to walk us through the conventions of the performance story.
Thanks, Leslie. The conventions are, there's less of them. There wasn't very many. And so I'm going to go ahead and just kind of talk about, for all three characters, kind of how it played out. So in a performance story, one of the conventions is training. So the protagonist must practice to gain or recover the skills necessary to perform. And so for Catherine, we see the story starts all the way back when she's a child and that they already recognize that she's a genius and that she's accepted into a school a few years early. And then she's, you know, goes on and gets to go to better and better schools because of her ability. So she starts her training off early. And then also within the context of the story at NASA, in order to solve the problem of the go, no-go orbit conversion, she returns to old math, Euler's method, something no one else thought to do. And then Dorothy, she learns how to program the IBM computer. She has to go to the library to get the Fortran book and teaches herself and then teaches the other human computers in the West group. And Mary, in order to become an engineer, she must take night classes at the all-white high school. But first, she must petition with the court to be able to attend the segregated school. So each character goes through their own little trials and training that they need in order to be able to get the skills they need to perform. So Valerie mentioned the All Is Lost moment. And first, I was kind of surprised to see this in our conventions list, but it is listed here as an explicit All Is Lost moment. The protagonist must understand that there is no getting around their imminent failure. And Valerie listed a couple items for Catherine that could possibly be, but this was one area I just felt like the movie didn't hit. I didn't really feel an All Is Lost moment. I don't feel like it was structured in a way that gave us that moment to really feel like there was an imminent failure. Is it because this is a historical story? So we know that John Glenn makes it. And in that way, the way you would structure the story would be to focus in a different spot. As an editor, I'm trying to think of what are some ways that the story could be structured in a different way that would have given us that gut punch, All Is Lost moment that we're so used to seeing. And does a story really work without it? Just it's interesting things to look at when the story works on so many other levels, but this was one area that it felt like it was lacking. The next convention is the mentor recovers a moral compass or betrays the protagonist to act out of perceived victimhood. So here, all of our mentors, everyone in the story, recovers their moral compass. So with Catherine, her mentor was Al Harrison, played by Kevin Costner. He shows this growing moral compass several times with knocking down the bathroom sign, with taking the colored only off of the coffee pot, letting her into the briefing, and letting her into the launch room. So we really get this moral character bordering on the white savior complex and that trope. Dorothy's mentor, in this case, I'm marking it as Mrs. Mitchell, who's her direct supervisor, played by Kirsten Dunst, who she struggles with. It's kind of her mentor and her antagonist are the same person. But by the end, you see her recover her moral compass and respectfully address her as Mrs. Vaughn. And she tells her that she's been made supervisor. And she asks her to teach some of the ladies in the East group computing, which would be the white group. And so then you get to see Dorothy teaching them. Mary's mentor, I'm listing as her husband. Again, it's kind of her antagonist. So I guess I'm kind of mixing the mentor antagonist here a little bit. But with Mary, it was that her husband changes his tune about supporting her attending these night classes and pursuing it through court to be able to attend the segregated school and chasing her dreams. And they have a really cute scene where he says he'll never get in her way again. Another convention is that the power divide between the antagonist and the protagonist is wide and deep. This one is without a doubt. This pulls on the society historical landscape where all of the characters face both the race and the gender divide. And as Black women, they have the lowest rank of power in the society because of their race and their gender. And so we really see that while this is a performance story, the society historical is really the setting that takes place. And so much of the society aspect is woven throughout the entire story. Now, this final convention, we've been talking about it a little bit on a Story Grid group, so I'm excited for us to have an opportunity to talk about it more in depth and hopefully provide some clarity for people on how to use it. The convention is the ironic win but lose or lose but win ending. So here in a performance story, in this one specifically, they won the respect of their colleagues and they achieved their career goals at NASA, but they still have to live in a world that is racist and sexist. So while they won the battle, they did not win the war. And while they are respected and not segregated within NASA itself, when you go out into the external world, they still very much have to deal with that. Also, Valerie mentioned, yes, they fought hard for recognition and won it. However, they were forgotten by history, and that this is highly ironic that the thing they fought so hard for, they didn't get until this book was written and then therefore made into a movie and put out into theaters. And now everyone, you know, has seen it and we're doing a podcast about it. And then, of course, you know, we can even tell with the naming of the NASA building and getting the Presidential Medal of Freedom, all of these things came, but they came so much later in life. So I wanted us to take a few minutes just to really talk about what this convention means for the win but lose or lose but win ending. There are several genres that this convention is a part of. Here in the performance where we have the value of shame versus esteem, it is something that we look for. Also within status, where the values are success and failure. In worldview, with all of the different subgenres there, you know, whether you're going from meaninglessness to meaning or naivete to sophistication or ignorance to knowledge, we're still looking for that win but lose, lose but win, ironic ending. And also within a society story where the values are power and impotence, we also are looking for that win but lose or lose but win ending. So as I was doing some research about this, I came across Pyrrhic victory, a phrase that's called for a victory that inflicts such a devastating toll on the victor that it is tantamount to defeat. So it's someone who wins a Pyrrhic victory has been victorious in some way, though the heavy toll negates that true sense of achievement or profit. Another term that I came across is a gambit, which is a calculated loss in exchange for a greater advantage. So therefore, it may look like you lose, but you know that you are getting a greater advantage anyway. But I was thinking that I think the point of this win but lose but win ironic ending is to show the cost of things, to show that many things, especially when we're dealing with these human needs tanks like esteem, self-actualization, and those kinds of things, that they can only really be appreciated and have their value truly understood when it's shown through the cost. So whether this is positive or negative, prescriptive or cautionary, it's really about, you know, what are you willing to go through or give up or to get these things? If we're talking about, let's say, a status story about success and failure or a society story about power and impotence, let's say that you do get this outward success, like you got that job or, you know, you won the election or whatever, and you get this success or power, but is it a Pyrrhic victory? At what toll did it take to get this achievement? And does that really count? Just to cite, you know, a well-known phrase from Matthew 16:26, for what will it profit a man if he gains the world but forfeits his soul? We understand the irony of that. Like, sure, you could do whatever it takes to get success, knowledge, or power, but at what cost? And I think that these stories are trying to show us that piece. So I've listed some examples here that I'll leave in the show notes that go through various performance, status, society, and worldview stories, just a few examples. But I think Anne and Leslie had some notes about this win but lose and lose but win ending also. So I'll pass it over to them.
You mentioned the Pyrrhic victory, and of course that is a definite war story idea. In the war genre, the Pyrrhic victory is kind of the negation of the negation. And I just wanted to point out that war and performance stories are very closely related, especially when performance stories involve team sports, where the culminating event is like the battle in a war story. And they both involve victory and honor or esteem versus defeat, dishonor, and shame. So I think I'm going to pass this off to Leslie, who has some very important things to say.
Okay, no pressure. So I think that there can be some confusion created by the term ironic or irony because it's used in different ways, even in the context of analyzing stories, to mean different things. So I would just ditch that actually. And I would say, you know, really focus in on that win but lose but win. And the fact that this is either a convention or obligatory scene of every genre, north, as I say, of the security tank, for example, the proof of love scene in the love story. So one of the things that Sean has mentioned is that to gain connection, love, esteem, actualization, or transcendence, the character must give something up. There is choice in life, right? We cannot have it all. And so understanding what we give up and what we gain is vital to understanding the character's choice. They give something up in some other level of Maslow's hierarchy, and it tends to be something that the character is extremely reluctant to give up. It has to be a hard and significant choice. And so I think focusing on that win but lose but win, and the difficulty, you know, the thing they give up is the way to really understand this convention when it shows up. So with that, I'm just going to touch quickly on the point of view and narrative device. We have a distinctly third-person point of view with varying narrative distance. We've got some really lovely newsreels and reports that serve as heralds within the story, particularly in the big event sequence. I thought it was really interesting that the men had their uniforms too, with short sleeved white shirts, ties, and black pants. The women wore more colorful shirts, and that created a stark contrast so that we could see that there are few women of color or white who are allowed in certain places. The narrative drive we know how the story ends, at least in terms of the mission. So we have dramatic irony, but that doesn't change the suspense we feel before and during the event for Catherine's and the other women's participation in it. So next we go through the objects of desire, in other words, the wants and needs. I think it's pretty uniform across the three women. They want to be respected for their work by their colleagues, their partners, and community. They need to do excellent work and speak up when the work is compromised. So one of the things that we'll talk about more in depth, but I want to just mention here, is that in an environment like NASA, where performance is vital to the mission, to success, and fools are not suffered very much, doing excellent work and speaking up when the work is compromised is important. Enduring hardships that are unrelated to performance seem to be part of the path of gaining respect. And so we'll discuss that again a little more below, but those are the basics of the objects of desire. In terms of the controlling idea, this is what I came up with for this story. Professional women of color gain the respect of their colleagues and community and keep their self-respect when they commit to doing excellent work and speaking up when the work is compromised. And there are lots of great examples of motifs that are expressing this controlling idea. As the African American are being told to settle, they are required to ride in the back of the bus. They have to drink from different water fountains, use different restrooms. Mrs. Mitchell says, "Be thankful you have jobs at all." So the all examples of you must settle. But Harrison's question to the entire group is, how do we find ourselves in second place in a two-man race in reference to the space race? Like, we must excel. We cannot settle. So this is a great example of the tension between the way the women are being expected to work and what's being asked of them. Okay, so the discussion you've all been waiting for, the good examples, special scene types. This is where we talk about special things about this story and insights that we've gained from watching it. Anne, you're going to start us off with some excellent set-offs and payoffs.
Yeah, this is pretty superficial stuff compared to some of the deeper things that we've been discussing. But one of the setups and payoffs in this was the motif of the string of pearls. It's the only jewelry the women were allowed to wear. And there's a throwaway reference to the restrictions on women in the workplace. And don't wear any jewelry except a string of pearls. But it becomes a key point in Catherine's midpoint shift rant, where she just screams out that she couldn't possibly afford pearls on the wage that they pay her. And finally, it becomes a symbol of the esteem that she's earned from her white colleagues by the end of the movie when they give her a string of pearls as a wedding gift. The other one that I really liked as a recurring motif was a bit more subtle and purely visual. In the prologue, the school principal hands little Catherine the chalk and asks her to prove herself on the blackboard, her mathematical ability. And this exact moment is recreated at the turning point of the middle build, where she has to prove herself again in front of this audience of extremely powerful white men. And there's that camera focus on the hand handing the piece of chalk to the other hand. And in the second instance, of course, it's a white man's hand giving the chalk to this black woman. So I liked those two motifs.
Oh, those are great. So one of the things that I noticed is that this film is rich with multiple layers of conflict. And for the main characters, we see them at home, as parents, as romantic partners, as people within the African-American community and the larger community, and of course at work. So we can really see what's at stake for them in their performance. And similar to Billy Elliot, the women inhabit completely different worlds when they're at work and when they're at home. And it's just a really lovely juxtaposition that we get to see a fairly, not a complete picture. I don't want to make that claim, but we do see more than we might in other stories and other types of stories. It was really interesting to me the use of computers, which we no longer think of as people who do computations, but non-human electronic machines. The women computers would have been replaced by the gigantic IBM machine, but for Dorothy's curiosity and willingness to learn and teach new skills. And it was also interesting to me that Russians was used to refer to the big bad guy in the story, when at the time it would have been the Soviets. And I have no opinion on why they might have chosen that, but it was an interesting choice.
As someone who was actually alive at this time, I can tell you that we talked about the Russians.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yep. I checked JFK's speech because I was like, well, maybe, and he used Soviets, but okay, awesome. So Mrs. Mitchell is a great example of Athena, the father's daughter archetype, who's the female defender of the patriarchy. And for me personally, this is the first movie where I understood that at least some of the urgency with the space race was a belief that winning was required for survival. So whether it's true or not, it provided a lot of drive for an action subplot.
Yeah, I thought going back to the obligatory scenes and the one where Catherine sidestepped her responsibility to perform, to me, that was an excellent example of one scene doing double or triple duty in a story. Sometimes when writers, and I speak as a writer myself, sometimes when writers are tackling the foolscap and they see this big, long list of things that needs to go in a story, especially if they're dealing with subplots or an internal and an external genre, it becomes very overwhelming to try and figure out how to get all of this stuff into a story. Well, one of the ways you can do it is to have one scene hitting a few different marks. And that scene where Catherine says, I can't work on what I can't see. This isn't petulance. She's not refusing to do the work because she's, you know, being sucky or just doesn't want to do it. She's underlining for Stafford and by extension for the audience, that this is an obstacle that is being put in her place willingly by the establishment, which prohibits her from doing the job that the establishment is asking her to do. It's an example of one of the many obstacles that not only women, but people of color are having put in front of them to keep them from advancing and to keep them from getting ahead in their respective area in life. So it's right on theme. It speaks to the global value shift. Even though this is a performance genre story, it speaks to the bigger, larger society issues. So I just thought this was a great example. It's kind of like that lunch scene that we looked at when we did Marathon Man, how that one scene did a lot of different things and operated on a lot of different levels. Well, I think that Catherine's refusal to perform scene operates on many different levels. And for me, it just makes it richer and more fascinating.
And that's great. Thank you, Valerie. So we want to talk about how this story is a great example of how the choice of genre influences the way the story is told and where the emphasis is placed and how the genre in turn impacts the story. So Valerie, you want to start us off with that?
Sure. Before we do these podcasts, before we start recording the podcast, we usually have a little chat. And this is something that really came up for all four of us today. And that is the creators of Hidden Figures could have approached this story from a number of different angles. It would have been a brilliant society story, for example. It could have been a story that was primarily internally driven for one of the internal genres. Instead, they chose to tell it as a performance genre. As a result, there are nods to what's going on in society. I mean, it does provide context for the story, and anyone who maybe doesn't know the context going into it can certainly suss it out from the information that they give. So it's there, but as a performance genre, as a business performance genre, the focus, therefore, is entirely on Catherine, Dorothy, and Mary's performance on the job. And that means it's a very different story than if it had been told as a society genre.
Kim and I discussed this last night, and we were looking at that all is lost moment and agreeing that it doesn't feel very high stakes, and we don't live in that deep moment. And that was what led us to this discussion of why this movie leaves us with a feeling of more cake than meat, I'll call it that. Although we do love a performance story, it is always a crowd pleaser, and we stand up and cheer because they win in the end. Go team. This is a large, sweet cake surrounding the bitter pill of racism and misogyny that the white audience and the male audience needs to swallow. And it's for that reason, the choice of a performance genre is the cake and allows or forces or, you know, makes it possible for us who are not women of color or African-American to swallow, at least, and begin to metabolize the really important underlying question, yet we walk away with a feeling that it was a little light, and yet it really worked. It's a funny feeling.
Yeah. So with that, I think it's exactly what you're saying, where the performance feels like this light, fluffy, kind of fun sort of story, where I really wanted to identify more with the women and their story and really feel their accomplishment in being able to, you know, withstand what they went through and stand up for themselves and do those things. So I think it would have been more satisfying to me if it had been the status admiration story as the global story. Parts of it that really bothered me were that the focus I felt like was taken away from the women and their accomplishment because so much was focused on, you know, we mentioned it earlier, like with Al Harrison's character, where he gets to come in and he gets to be the savior of the moment. And I feel like that detracts from Catherine's amazing speech or from, you know, just different parts that to me would have felt more rewarding, I think, as a viewer and as a woman to have the weight of it stay with them instead of getting brushed over and be given to the group. You know, this is a mini plot. But having the story be spread around between three protagonists, as well as kind of split with the white characters or the hierarchy, the patriarchy of NASA and society as a whole, because it gets so divided, I feel like I don't get that same rich gut feeling, that meaty feeling that I really ache for in a story. And so I feel like that's maybe where it lost it a little bit for me. I wanted more. I don't want the cake. You know, I want to see it, what it is, and I want to feel it, and I want to experience it in that true raw form. And so that's where it kind of leaves me lacking a little bit.
I totally see that and understand that point of view. And in a way, I'm thinking about this from the point of view of the people telling the story and what their goal was. And we can't know that specifically, but one of the things I'm thinking about is when people are reluctant to see a particular truth, that sometimes it helps for them to see what's in it for them. And the borderline cautionary tale here is we had a narrow miss. That mission could have gone really badly. And these three women, and indeed all the women, these three women as representatives of other women who participated in this effort to make it happen, make it successful, because a loss at that point would have been a crushing blow in terms of morale in the country. And so I think sometimes when you present a story in this way, it can go further into more minds and hearts and begin to change them, which is not to downplay the misogyny and the racism and the really bad choices that society and the establishment were making at the time. It's not to apologize for that at all, but to understand that when we're telling a story, we have a particular goal in mind of a message we're trying to convey to a particular ideal reader or ideal viewer. And that by speaking directly to that person and being specific, we make it universal so that there's cake for everyone. And that was kind of my take on that, which is not necessarily right or wrong, just a different perspective.
And Leslie, I just wanted to jump in for and say one more thing. As writers listening to this podcast or editors who are listening to this podcast, I think the key takeaway here is, what kind of story do you want to tell? What's the point of your story? What angle do you want to take on the story? And what's your key message? What's your controlling idea? Because that is really going to determine which genre you're going to choose for your story. Because as we said, Hidden Figures as a performance story is very different than Hidden Figures told as a society story or as an action story, because it's not an action story. It could very well have been if the emphasis had been on the launch and the, you know, there is a clock in there, but we don't really feel the clock. It's mentioned, but there's no sense of real urgency about it as there would be if this was a performance story, an action story. But because it's a performance story, everything is told through the filter of, will these three women be given the respect they deserve and the recognition they deserve for their talent and their ability? So what kind of story is it you want to tell? And which genre will help you tell that story best?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Well, that wraps it up for this week. Great discussion. Thank you so much, Anne, Kim, and Valerie, for your excellent editorial insights into Hidden Figures. We hope our discussion helps you write a better performance story. You can find the Foolscap and other materials in the show notes. And we'd like to invite our listeners in the StoryGrid community to comment, argue with us on our interpretations. And if you have a favorite movie that you'd like to suggest, you can write to us on Twitter at StoryGridRT. Join us again next time when we'll be taking on the action genre with the 2000 Taiwanese martial arts hit Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Why not give it a look during the week and follow along with us? Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.